I find it helpful in looking at practice and looking at life, my life, to consider that the present moment has two aspects. There is the aspect of what's happening in the present moment, whatever it might be, externally in the world or internally within us. There's what's happening. And then there's the way that we're relating to what's happening. And Buddhist practice belongs to that second category, you know, how we relate to what's happening. And part of Buddhist practice then is to have some intentionality, some choice, some will, some involvement in how we relate to what our present moment experience is. Part of the present moment experience, when there's no practice or no sense of having some choice in the matter, part of the present moment experience is our unconscious or subconscious or automatic or habitual response to the present moment, which colors it and affects it. And often the way we respond, the way we relate to the present moment, there's many different aspects of that. There's our attitudes towards the present moment. There's our intentions. There's our views, our understanding about the present moment. We bring a lot to bear on the present moment. And often that's invisible to us. We don't see that because it's happened so spontaneously, so naturally, so seemingly. We think it's just inherent in existence that this is the way things are. And we don't even necessarily know that we're actually contributing something to the present moment in our understanding of the present moment. So a kind of very kind of mundane example would be if you're driving down the street and you see on the intersection, the corner of the intersection, the sidewalk, a pole. On top of that pole is a box. And on top of that box, there's three colored glass, circles of glass. One is red, and one is yellow, and one is green. And if you watch that for a while, you see that a light lights up behind them at intervals, alternately, differently, at times. They don't seem to all light up at the same time, but sometimes the green one lights up, and sometimes the yellow, and sometimes the red one. And that's interesting, right? I mean, just a pole with a box with lights. But we see that, kind of, most of us, pretty spontaneously as being a traffic light. And that the red, green, and yellow lights have meaning. And when they light up, it means something for us when we're driving. And that we should respond accordingly. And there might be there's a certain understanding then that goes into seeing that box of lights. And it's so ingrained or so inherent or so easy part of how the mind works. But it's the working of the mind. The mind has to be active, has to understand, has to project that understanding on the situation, and has to have certain intention or relationship to that understanding. And it gets pretty complex pretty quickly when you tease apart what goes on when we see this box on a pole that has lights in it. And there might be all kinds of attitudes towards that pole with a box that has lights on it. There might be attitudes of annoyance. Gee, you know, doesn't it realize I'm in a hurry to get somewhere? It's an imposition on my freedom to do anything I want and go. I have to stop with this red light. And then you might have all kinds of fantasies that get born because of that. But wouldn't it be great to have a little kind of device, a little radio device in your car, only in your car, no one else's car, that somehow communicated to those lights so whenever you came to the intersection, it was always green for you. Now, wouldn't that be great? There might be a certain level of fear arises. In relationship to that light as it turns yellow and you consider, I think I can make it. And so, so there's a amount of fear. You know, you kind of hope there was no car, no police car. No car that's painted black and white that has these lights on top of the roof that somehow, is in the neighborhood that could watch you. That, black and white car with lights on top means something. And there's a whole attitude, not just, all attitudes, understandings, and intentions in relationship to this black and white car with lights on the roof. And so we live in a world where there's a lot, we bring to bear a lot. We add a lot to what we see, what the immediacy of the experience is, in terms of views, understandings, attitudes, emotions, a lot that goes on. If we just kind of go along in our lives, not taking any responsibility for what we contribute to the present moment, then our contribution to the present moment will be habitual, will be very much influenced by our reactivity, our greed, our ignorance, our aversions, our the ways we've been conditioned by society, conditioned by our life experiences. And in a sense, we're kind of then just, I wanted to use the word victim, I don't know if it's the best, very good choice of words, but a victim of, just kind of passive recipient of life, passive kind of passenger in our life, and things happen, and we don't take much responsibility for what's happening to us. My understanding of Buddhist practice is that it really has a lot to do with taking responsibility for that contribution that we add to our present moment experience, so that we are start becoming clearer and clearer about where the choice is, and begin changing the organizational principles for how we choose and our intentions from being motivated by greed, hate, and delusion to being motivated by wisdom and compassion. So Buddhist understanding is that most people who don't really start taking responsibility for their actions in life, their views of life, their reactivity, is very much influenced by greed, hate, and delusion, or the different varieties of that. And Buddhist practice is moving us in the direction of changing that so that the organizing motivations, reactions for our life are not greed, hate, and delusion, but rather becomes wisdom and compassion. And so we organize our life, and how we choose to respond, how we respond, becomes out of wisdom and compassion. And that also, as becomes deeply, kind of deeply enters into us in some way, can at some point start becoming almost a natural response, seemingly spontaneous response, seemingly as if it's not a choice anymore that we're acting out of compassion and wisdom, but becomes who we are in a certain way. So I'd like to read you a story about intention, the attitude we bring to what we do, to what our situation is. It's a story about a man who is transformed, kind of almost seemingly led along by the different people he encounters, each person doing the same activity, but each person doing the activity with a different attitude, a different intention, a different thing that they bring to the same activity. And this has to do with a man who was an abbot of a Zen monastery. The abbot was a most unusual man. He seemed always to have a smile in his eyes and a look as if he knew you better than you knew yourself. He once told this story about himself. When I was 13, my family would send me up to the mountains around the monastery to collect edible plants to be used for our evening meal. This foraging trip was the only work that I enjoyed doing. Otherwise, I tried every trick I could to avoid work on my family's farm. I was still going to school, but school had no interest for me, and my ever-present anger was a welcome barrier to learning anything the teacher was teaching. Occasionally, during my foraging trips, I would pass by the monastery while the monks were out and about sweeping the leaves from the many paths. The first time I saw the monks working, I was mesmerized in watching them going about their work. For many months afterwards, I would often stop for a while to watch them sweep. They went about their work silently and with an efficiency that seemed effortless. One day, a monk walked up to me and asked what I was doing in the mountains. Immediately, I became defensive and scared. I resented anyone who tried to get to know me. So instead of answering the question, I countered by asking him what he was doing. The monk smiled and answered that he'd been told to sweep and that he was just killing time until he could return to his room for a nap. As I walked home later in the day, I thought about his answer and was glad that he did not seem any different than myself. When I was required to do anything, my heart was never in it, and my attitude was that I was passing time until I could be excused. Taking a nap was certainly preferable. The next day, I passed by the monastery on one of my foraging trips, and another monk stopped his sweeping and also asked what I was doing. Again, I resented the question. It felt like an intrusion. However, this time, I did not feel as scared. Again, I deflected the question by asking what he was doing. He answered that he was doing extra work in hopes of being assigned to the kitchen, which was warm in the winter, and always seemed to have one or two extra sweet rice cakes in the cupboard for cooks to nibble on. Without saying anything, I nodded and left to continue my foraging. The monk's answer resonated with me, since I too like to be warm, and eating sweet cakes was one of my favorite activities, second only to sleeping. The next time I passed the monastery, a third monk asked me the same question. This time, I was surprised that I wasn't defensive or resentful of being asked. However, again, I deflected the question back to him. He explained that he was sweeping as a spiritual discipline to help him overcome his anger. Later, as I walked the mountain trail with my bag of plants, I felt a kinship with this monk. Like me, he had anger, but I was perplexed that he would want to overcome it. For me, my anger protected me. A week later, I was again outside the monastery watching the monks sweep. Yet another monk came up to me. When he asked me what I was doing, I mumbled something about collecting plants. I doubt he could hear me. My voice was so faint. But I did muster up some strength to ask him what he was doing. He replied that he was beautifying the monastery so that others may be inspired in their work of spiritual transformation. Before I left him, I glanced down the well-swept paths and realized that part of the reason I was compelled to watch the monks sweep was that they seemed to be transforming the paths into something that made me feel peaceful. The next time I stood outside the monastery watching the monks, I was drawn to walk over to a fifth monk, and before he could ask me what I was doing, I asked him. He looked at me with kind eyes. And after what seemed like a long but quite soft silence, he explained that he was sweeping to be of service to all who used the monastery. In practicing this way, he hoped to find the ultimate peace. As I left the monastery that day, I thought his answer strange, as I didn't understand what he meant by service and by peace. I certainly couldn't see how these had any value for me. The next time I visited the monastery for the last time, I had an unfamiliar feeling as I walked up into the mountains. Just before I reached the monastery, I guessed that I was looking forward to seeing the monks again. I felt a warm glow of gladness in anticipation of what I would find. When I arrived at the monastery, I walked right up to the old monk who seemed absorbed in his sweeping. I inquired what he was doing. As he answered, each of his words washed over me like cleansing water. "Me?" he said. "I am not doing anything. My ego was swept away long ago. There is no I that does anything. Now the awakened life moves through my body, my mind, my heart, and my mouth. No one sweeps. There are no paths to sweep. And there is no dirt to brush away." I was stunned by his answer, and before I could respond, he handed me the broom and walked away. I have been here ever since. So each of the monks had a different attitude to the sweeping. The same activity, but different attitudes. Do you have any choice in the attitude you bring to your activities, to whatever you do, to the life that you live? The part of what in maybe in modern psychotherapeutic terms, creates a strong sense of self, is to have a strong sense of purpose and values for our life. And then to be able to organize our life and our intentions and the direction of our life according to those aims and those values. And the same is true in Buddhist practice. And what Buddhist practice suggests is that it's possible to organize one's life around long-term aims and very deep values that have a coherence to them, that work together. And part of having a healthy sense of self or a healthy way of living life is to have our life organized around coherent values and coherent aims for what our life is about. And not just simply responding to the moment in the moment for its value, what happens in the moment, but as we respond to the moment, as we make choices of how we live in the moment, to understand how it works in supporting long-term values and aims for our life. And so to have some sense of purpose, some sense of value, some sense of intentions and attitudes that are useful to bring to bear on how we respond to the present moment. And to have some sense of how that might fit into long-term aims. One of my favorite stories, or little examples, which maybe I've talked about enough, but the one of the parallel lines. Have I talked about that recently? That if you take two parallel lines, it's almost parallel. Just there's a shade of an angle difference. And for a long time, you can look at those almost parallel lines kind of going off into the horizon, and they seem like they're parallel. You know, they seem like, you know, you can follow along and they seem like no change. But if you follow long enough, a week or a year or 10 years, slowly there's a divergence, and those lines will go further and further and further apart. And after 10 years, it's a huge and important difference between, you know, the direction they've gone. So the same thing in our life. If we make a small change in our life, regular change, that seems almost insignificant today, then over the weeks and the months and the years, if we maintain that direction, it can make a huge difference down the line. If we start trying to act just a little bit kinder in our life, just a little bit, just a small little teeny ways today, that kindness can grow and make a big difference in 10 years. If we try to be a little bit more mindful in our life today, just a little bit, that's making that as a direction for our life can make a big difference. And if we're measuring the success of our practice in a daily way, I've been practicing mindfulness for a day and there's no difference, I think I'll give up and try something else. That's kind of too quick to judge. But if you have the idea that there can be a long-term goal and how these lines separate over time, that you can make a huge difference down the line. Just, for example, sitting every day, doing a meditation practice every morning and sitting every day might not seem so significant in one day or 2 days or in a week, or maybe sometimes maybe in a month or in a year. But over a lifetime, it can make a huge difference. 10 years into the future might seem so far ahead, so far into the future, that why would you even bother about it? Why would you even think about that? But if you think back 10 years from where you are today, boy, I wish I'd started 10 years ago. Because boy, then today it'd be really different. 10 years from now, for a lot of you, will just be a blink of the eye once you get there. And having started today to try to take care of 10 years from now can be very significant in 10 years. So to have a coherent sense of values and coherent sense of an aim, I think, is a very important part of Buddhist practice. And my suggestion is that in Buddhist terms, and you don't have to be a Buddhist or even adopt Buddhist terms, but this is a Buddhist center, so I'm allowed to say it, is to begin orienting towards the cultivation and development and the response of compassion and wisdom. To begin to explore and bring to bear on the present moment an intention to meet the situation with compassion and wisdom. And the word intention is a very important one here, because intention is not positive thinking where you're overlaying or repressing or denying what's there and trying to kind of pretty it up. Part of the wisdom is to be very honest about what is here in the present moment. So to bring honesty to bear with the present, to be really honest, what's happening now? And then given that honesty of what's happening now, what is useful intention to have in relationship to this? And the intention doesn't mean that you have to be, like if the intention is to be kind, it doesn't mean that you need to stop being angry, or you deny it or push that away, or sweep it away or something. But it means, oh, can that be my aspiration? Can I, you know, in spite of my anger, can I, being honest about the anger being there, can I act on an intention, an aspiration of kindness, of compassion? For sometimes the wisest way of responding to the present moment is to get out of the way of the present moment, to seemingly not interfere with it, to not have any intention to try to do anything with it or respond with kindness or with compassion or wisdom, but rather just kind of be very spacious and very open and kind of about just let it be. And that's a very wise response. But that's still a response that we can choose to respond, you know, way of responding. There's a lot of different responses that we can bring. And Buddhist practice has a wide range of practices, of ideas, of how you might respond to the present moment. The point today in this talk is that a very important part of wise living is to begin taking responsibility for how we respond to the present moment. And beginning to take small moments of responsibility might seem insignificant, but as you begin exercising that muscle taking responsibility of choosing to respond differently than the habitual way or the conditioned way, that slowly changes who we are. It changes the psyche, changes the heart and the mind. So that the psyche, which is malleable, can begin having as its organizing principle, as its organizing orientation, as its software that runs the program, something like compassion and wisdom as its organizing principle. Having goals, having an aim for our life, having a coherent aim, and being very clear about what our intentions are in the short term and also in the long term can give a lot of power to a person's life, a lot of strength, a lot of inspiration. To not have a coherent sense of purpose and goal for our life can actually drain a lot of our power, a lot of our energy, a lot of our kind of, you know, the coherence brings a lot of power. Today I read a little bit in the paper. I read it out loud to my son in the Chronicle. About 50 years ago, there was, I guess, three men were competing to break the 4-minute mile to run. And these guys had this really, you know, had a lot of power because of the strength of their intention and how they organized their life around trying to train in order to be able to be the first humans who could run faster than 4 minutes. And apparently two years of really intense training, these three guys in different places in the world competing to do that. They had a certain coherence and power that came from that kind of focus and what their life was about. It's possible in Buddhist practice to have similar kind of focus and intention and coherence. This is what my life is about. It doesn't mean that you have to compete for the Olympics, the Buddhist Olympics. But it's possible to have a certain strength, power, each of us in our lives, by the focus that we have, the purpose that we have, the value we have about how we're going to organize our life, what our life is going to be focused around. I would suggest that you look at your lives honestly and carefully. Use your mindfulness, use your reflection, use your contemplation, use your discussions with your friends to try to understand much better and honestly what it is that tends to motivate the choices you make in your life, what motivates how you respond to your present moment experience, the motivation behind your long-term aims, if you have any. So look at it honestly and fully and completely. And what is the underlying motivation there? To what degree is it influenced by the varieties of greed or ambition? To what degree is it motivated by the varieties of aversion or ill will or hate or avoidance? And what degree is it motivated by delusion or ignorance, confusion? And is it possible, is it interesting, would it be useful for you to bring to bear, to bring up, to evoke, to arouse, compassion and wisdom as the organizing principles? In the Buddhist tradition, there's a lot of emphasis on not-self, which is a very confusing topic for a lot of people. And in the story, the last monk talked about, this in some indirect way. He talked about me. I am not doing anything. My ego was swept away long ago. There is no I that does anything. So this idea of no I, not self. The arhat, the person who's fully awakened, the awakened person, doesn't become some wishy-washy person, kind of just goes along and with how things are, and there's no self here to kind of relate to anything, so traffic lights don't mean anything, and and police cars don't mean anything, and whatever goes, goes, and trash is on the ground, their dirty dishes pile up in their sink, it's fine, there's no self here to be concerned about dirty dishes, and no self here, I'll just trust the spontaneous working, of my mind or whatever. The person who's enlightened, I would suggest, maybe has, in a sense, no self-identity, no strong sense of self around which they coalesce or which they're craving or gripping onto. But what they have in sense is a very powerful and cohering impulse towards compassion and wisdom. And there's a tremendous coherence in the life, I think, of someone who's fully awakened. And I'll end with a little study that was done some 20 years ago. When some psychologists went to India, or some psychologists were taking these, I apologize for not pronouncing it well, Rorschach blots. You're supposed to look at these blots, and then you have people interpret what they see, tell you what they see there. And based on what they see, you can kind of understand something about the psychology of the person. So they went around and did that to a lot of different people, and people who meditated a lot, and to see if the meditation changed who they were. And they did it for people at the beginning of their 3-month retreat, the end of the 3-month retreat, to see the changes. And then they went to India to do these tests on two of the people who are understood to be some of the most realized in our particular tradition of Vipassana. And they were blown away by the results, what they saw. Because as they looked at these blots of ink, their interpretation, what they saw there, was Dharma teachings. That's what they saw, was teachings on wisdom and compassion. That's how they tended to see the world. It was through that filter, through that understanding. If you left here today, and you were going to see the unfolding of your life over the next couple of hours as you got in your car, and you went home, or went to whatever you're going to do next, the singles brunch, or the meeting of gays and lesbians and so forth, and cleaning the temple afterwards, or whatever you had to do next. And if you were going to enter that situation, not with greed or hate or fear, but enter it with love and compassion, what would it be like for you? And maybe you can't enter it with love and compassion, but more important, almost more important, maybe more important than that, is not being able to do it with love and compassion, but to have the intention, the wish and the desire that this would be really good if you could. And what would it be like to try? To have the intention, to water the seeds of that intention, to give a chance for that intention to surface. Part of what we do in meditation, there's many things that happens in meditation, but part of it, meditation, is learning to relax. And one of the things we're relaxing is the grip of the old motivations, intentions, responses, the habitual ones, the unhealthy ones that we're kind of in the grip of us often, that seemingly we have no choice but to respond that way, our fear. And to relax that, so in that relaxed space, there's a chance for other intentions, deeper intentions, to begin filling the space. I learned at some point in my practice that if I wasn't afraid in certain settings, certain situations, that if my mind had no fear, I didn't have to think. There'd be very little thoughts in my mind. And there was a very powerful connection between fear and needing to think. And I didn't disappear. I wouldn't become some zombie when the fear wasn't there. Just the mind seemed very peaceful and empty in many ways. But in that emptiness, it was like an empty container that wasn't ready to be filled by something else. So may you all become emptier vehicles so that you can be filled with love and compassion and wisdom. So we have a couple of minutes, a few minutes, if anyone wants to make any comments or would like to ask any questions.
How do you manifest intentions and long-term goals if you're intent on being alone?
So how would you manifest long-term goals if you were intent on being in the moment? It's possible that you have a long-term goal to be fully present. And so you have to do it in small steps to be fully present in this moment. And you just keep it up. But if you don't have the long-term sense of aspiration of what's possible, you might not keep it up to do it. That's one way it manifests. But just being fully present, there's a lot more that goes into being fully present. To be fully present is kind of like a empty container that's only a quarter full. When you're fully present, what do you bring to that? You could be a fully present thief, right? Thieves are really present. You know, they got to be, otherwise they end up in jail. And so, what else do you bring to being fully present? And having a long-term sense of I can change myself. I can become a better person. I can become a freer person. I can become a more compassionate person. And this is something I'd like to work with in my life. And in order to do that, I have to be fully present. But in being fully present, then how do I meet what I'm present for? So I would encourage you to add a little bit more to your practice of being fully present. Or understand being fully present in a little bit wider view. Is that a good enough answer? Enough for you to think about? That maybe not a good answer, but if it's enough for you to think about for a while, I'm content.
The values part implies study.
It can sometimes, initially. It doesn't have to, but it could.
I'm just wondering, where do the goals come in?
Where do the goals come in? They come into our intention. I mean, where do they come from, you mean? Or how do you decide which goals? Or
it feels goals in this culture feels like a contracting around a thing.
Yes, it can be. So a lot of Buddhist teachers have come to the West and have talked a lot about the importance of being goalless in practice, of having a practice which has no goal, has no purpose beyond itself, and letting go of everything but just being fully in the present. There's a lot of wisdom to that approach of practice. And there's two things I'd like to say, a lot of things I could say about that. One is, it was a really important medicine for people who grew up in Western culture. Because we contract often around a goal. And we compare ourselves, we strive and all that. And we just needed to relax. And having goalless practice was the best way to relax. The other is that kind of approach to practice is also sometimes understood in Buddhism to be the highest practice. And sometimes people will take the highest practice as the only practice they're allowed to do. And there are a lot we can do in Buddhist practice, a lot that we can do in a wise life. And sometimes, one traditional understanding is that you don't do the highest practice until you have a really good foundation for it first. And so first you get the foundation in order, and then you do the highest practice of being goalless. If you do it too soon, you end up in trouble. Another thing is that goalless practice can coexist with a goal. They don't have to be exclusive of each other. So, So you said something about study. I think it's really valuable in any human life to spend some time reflecting on what our deepest values are. And then and exploring it in different ways and trying to see, you know, what are the values you really want to live by? And it affects things like things like the kind of car you drive. To be goalless and fully in the present moment is not going to help you decide to get a car that consumes less fuel. But some people, that's a value they have. And there was an interesting car parked out here. I'd love to hear, if the person's here, maybe they stay afterwards and tell me about it. There's a car parked out there, a little Honda, right out here on Hopkins, that has City Car Share written on the side. Is that yours?
Yeah.
Yeah? So it's not your car. You just kind of grabbed a hold of it. Collective in San Francisco, we share their share cars, and you just jumped in this morning and drove down here.
Well, sort of. I have to make a reservation online, pay a monthly membership if you need it, pay for miles, and pay for the gas, pay by the hour, pay by the miles you drive.
And how many people share that car?
Maybe hundreds.
Hundreds of people share that car. It looked like a nice car.
Yeah.
It looked clean and good shape and real convenient, and it's, you know, there's probably saves the environment lots of things.
Space. Insurance and parking tickets.
You don't get parking tickets in San Francisco?
Well, I have to be careful. When you own a car, it's always a liability.
Sorry?
When you own a car in the city, if you don't drive a lot, you don't have to drive to work, you'd be a lot of trouble. Or if you don't have $1 million garage.
You have to pay for parking meters? Or you're exempt from parking meters?
No, unfortunately not.
Oh. I see. Those are great. So isn't that great? You know, some places in the world have these bicycles that they kind of leave and everybody jumps on the bicycle. And
Amsterdam,
yeah.
And
Palo Alto. Palo Alto bicycles?
Yeah.
Yeah, just the local right here. And so cars. And, you know, what if we, you know, it's like a library, right? We don't have to have the same book. We don't have to all own the same book. We just go to the library and borrow it. So we have this car library.
Exactly.
And so, you know, we don't need as many cars.
Also.
So just being fully in the present moment doesn't really help a person make the decision to do something like that, right?
No, I have to plan.
But you have to be fully present. You have to plan for it, right?
No.
You have to plan for it and think about it. So any life at all requires planning and thinking and intention and values. There is no life without it. And so and it's valuable to be fully present. And then it allows you, once you make that decision and that goal to join that club, that stuff, then you can let go of that. Then when you drive down here, you can be fully present for driving. And you can let go, and you have to let go of the, maybe you have to let go of the goal of getting down here to drive well. But you have to know what direction you're going. It's like, I heard the other day someone say that if you drive up in Canada, Mount McKinley, if you're going to go drive to Mount McKinley, it's apparently really flat in the area around there, flat enough. So you can see Mount McKinley far, far in the distance. And if you want to go there on the road, you have to have an intention to get there, a long-term goal to get there. But you got to keep your eye on the road. You don't keep your eye on Mount McKinley, because then you drive off the road. So you have to know when to let go of a goal and when to have it. And sometimes they work at different times. And so having part of having a goal sometimes is to reflect on it, set your sights on that goal, and then know how to forget it as you take the steps to get there. Yeah.
That's a good question.
Yeah, please.
I've just come out of an intensive period of Soto Zen practice. And before that, I did the long retreat at Spirit Lodge last year. And I was very interested in making some contact with you because I know you've done both positions. You're a recognized teacher in both positions. And I'm not sure there's a short way for you to summarize this question, but I'm curious to know, or I'd be curious to talk to you maybe another time in more detail, what your thoughts are about the forms of Soto Zen, whether or not you found for yourself that they just became burdensome and got in the way, or whether it's better to just let go and be in the present moment and recognize that you're using forms and tools to be in the present.
So the question is about monastic forms, and Soto Zen has a lot of them because Soto Zen kind of brought with it monastic forms from Asia in a way that the Vipassana community hasn't. But the Vipassana world has a lot of this, in the Theravadan world, in its monastic environment, has a lot of the same forms, in some places more and some places less. So it's not really a question that needs to kind of be about Soto Zen. It could just be about forms in general. And I think that forms are very important. There's no life without forms. And some places have more formless forms, and some places have more form forms, but there's always forms. And then the question is, are they useful? How are they useful? When are they useful? When are they not useful? When do they get in the way? And those are very important issues. And I found monastic forms, Soto Zen and others, to be very helpful for me, and something which I learned to deeply appreciate. And the way I was taught Soto Zen was you have to, at the same time, see through the forms and see their emptiness and see their usefulness and the purpose and their value kind of plunge into them at the same time as seeing that they have no ultimate value. And so I found it really lovely to do the forms. And I never really found them to be a burden, monastic forms. But there was a change at some point where various changes at various times where they lost, one change was they lost their mystique. That was very important, kind of some kind of aura, charisma of this great, mysterious, wonderful practice. And they just became these forms, we do, and they have value, and they're kind of, child's play. When I worked in the kitchen at Tassajara, when I started the year in the kitchen seemed so big and daunting and challenging and confusing place to be, and I was intimidated and all that. After spending a whole year in the kitchen seemed so small and so easy, and I was so big in relationship to it, and I could just, spin around. I became huge. I'd grown physically, So my whole relationship to that, changed from being kind of intimidated and small in the midst of it. So same thing with monastic forms. When I started, I was an intimidated little kid. And at some point, to some degree, a little bit, I grew up, and this form just seemed kind of...
Would you say you passed through them? Sort of grew out of that whole way of practicing?
Did I grow out of it?
Yeah.
I'm a little bit reluctant to say that I outgrew them. But I'm not following Soto Zen form so much these days, in a strict sense. I think some of the value that they had, a lot of the value they had when I was earlier in my life, when I was kind of immersed in that world, no longer serves that value anymore. But I don't want to say that I've grown them. Okay. So many thanks for this morning, and it's nice to be here. And I wish you all well on your short-term and long-term goals.